All right, good morning, everyone, to the diehards who don't run up north when it gets a little hot down here. First of all, a reminder that tonight, Rabbi Brand, our colleague at BRS West, is going to be giving a shiur at 8 o'clock tonight on a sefer that he's been writing for 40 years on the number 4. And having looked through it, it literally is everything you ever wanted to know and more about the number 4, obviously with regards to Pesach and the Haggadah, and more. So everyone is encouraged to come tonight. He'll have copies of his sefer there. It's really an enormous accomplishment to have worked on a project for 40 years and to be able to bring it to fruition and to share it with the community. And so we're grateful for all of Rabbi Brand's leadership, certainly at BRS West, his participation in so many of the classes here at BRS. And we're looking forward to celebrating the launching of his sefer tonight. Again, that's at 8 p.m. in the social, everyone is encouraged to attend. What I want to do today is try to make sense of a very complicated parsha, one that at first glance seems a little bit enigmatic and difficult to follow. And if there was ever a parsha where you were going to come to shul in the morning and say, you know what, maybe I'll bring a nice Jewish book with me to read during Torah reading, one could argue that if you made a top 5 of parshios, so Tazria / Metzora might fall in on one of those 5 parshios. But we're going to give it meaning today, hopefully give us a little bit more understanding into some of the complex ideas of Tazria and Metzora. And ultimately, my goal is that when you leave today, you will be a better person. How does that sound? Okay. To start off, I want us to all envision heaven. Now, please God, none of us will be there for a very long period of time. But let's envision heaven for just a second. Now, if you're like me, you've had images of what Olam Haba, heaven, whatever word you want to use, but we'll use heaven for now, looks like. In all likelihood, there's a throne there. There's God. There are little angels scurrying around. Right? Each one of us, really, I would imagine, since childhood, has some form of a vision that when I say heaven, something pops into your mind. There's some image that pops into your mind. Well, if you think about what happens in heaven, so there's a very famous Gemara which gives us added insight into the types of conversations that take place in heaven, and it's an insight that we ordinarily wouldn't necessarily associate with what exactly Hashem and the angels are doing when they're in heaven. So if you look on the page that I just gave you, you have an English translation of a very famous Gemara, famous because I know it and you're about to know it, but a very famous Gemara in Bava Metzia, page 86a. Now the Gemara is talking about Rabba Bar Nachmani, who is a very righteous rabbi and is running away from the Persians. And again, if you want to see, the Gemara has an entire discussion about how he's running away, what it takes to run away, why he's running away. Let's all skip that for now. Nonetheless, there is a Persian agitator that is chasing after him, that wants to capture him and bring him back to the authorities. And that is where we pick up our Gemara. They take this messenger from the Persians, they bring him into a small vestibule, and they close the door before him. He wants to meet Rabba Bar Nachmani. Of course, Rabba Bar Nachmani wants to get out of this meeting because it will not end well for him. Rabba Bar Nachmani prays for mercy, and the wall crumbled. He fled and went to hide in a swamp. Okay, so he evades the police. He runs into a swamp. And that's where the bulk of our story picks up. So here again, you got to envision. Great Talmudic scholar sitting in a swamp. Bugs, mosquitoes, mud all around. He's sitting on the stump of a palm tree and studying Torah alone. Just what you and I would be doing if we were also in a swamp evading Persian authorities. At that moment, the sages in the heavenly academy. Oh, so now I'm excited. Because our question is, what happens in heaven? And now the Gemara is going to tell us exactly what happens in heaven. That there were a bunch of sages sitting around, and they were disagreeing with regard to the halacha of Tzarat, our parsha. They're discussing exactly what you and I are debating right here. That's what is awaiting us in heaven. You get to have eternity of Tazria and Mitzora over and over and over again. What could be better than that? Someone just said that's Gehenna. We're going to get to that. It's not. Okay? So here we go. Here we go. In general, a leprous spot includes two signs of impurity, a bright white spot and a white hair. The basic halacha is that if the snow-white leprous baheret, in other words, the sore, preceded the hair, then the afflicted person is impure. But if the hair preceded the baheret, the spot, he is pure. Okay, that's an explicit pasuk in our parsha this week, and it's an explicit halacha. If the spot comes before the hair, then you are tame. If the hair comes before the spot, you are tahor. Pretty simple. All of us can now be kohanim. We're ready for the Beis HaMikdash to come, reinstitute the laws of tzarat. Not so fast. What are they debating about? The heavenly debate concerned a case of uncertainty as to which came first. Don't forget, you didn't always watch it appear on your skin. You might wake up in the morning and lo and behold, there is both a spot and a skin that is white. And you now have to figure out which came first. Well, you can go to the videotape, but they didn't have that back then. So what means do they have for determining this doubt? So the Gemara says that this is exactly what they're debating. Suffolk. What happens if there is a doubt? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer Tahor. So God comes out with his beaming voice. Think about Heston, Ten Commandments. So it shall be written and so it shall be done, right? The famous. So God comes out and says, Tahor, he is pure. V'kulhu misifta derakia. But every other member of this heavenly academy, there is a base medrash that exists in heaven, and God says Tahor, and everybody else in the Beis Medrash, Amri, Tame. They say this person is Tame. Now, there's a debate between God and the students in heaven. What do they do? How do they arbitrate this type of debate? The Amri, they said, Ma nuchach, Rabba Bar Nachmani. Who is the one who's going to arbitrate this dispute? And they agree on Rabba Bar Nachmani because Rabba Bar Nachmani was known as the preeminent scholar in the laws of Tzaras. Can you imagine what his Shabbos table was like? You try to make conversation, and he talks about Tzaras. You ask him how the weather is, he talks about Tzaras. You ask him how the Red Sox and the Yankees are doing, and he tells you about Tzaras. So they say, there's nobody better to adjudicate this debate between God on the one hand, who says Tahor, and the heavenly Beis Medrash on the other hand, which says Tameh. And they say the only person in this world or the next world who can decide this halacha is this rabbi by the name of Rabba Bar Nachmani, who happens to be in a swamp learning Torah, evading Persian authorities. Good so far. Not exactly how we pictured heaven. So what do? They send a messenger from heaven after him to take his soul up to the heavenly academy. For some reason, he can't paskin the halacha down on earth. They have to bring him up and have him paskin the halacha in heaven itself. But there's a problem. The angel of death was unable to approach Rabba Bar Nachmani because he was constantly learning Torah. We have this example other places in the Gemara, where the Gemara tells us that as long as a person is learning Torah uninterrupted, the angel of death can't touch them. And so you have various stories of how the angel of death had to distract the person learning Torah so that he could get him for a split second, grab him away. That's exactly what's happening with Rabbi Nachmani. He's learning Torah with such diligence that the angel of death can't touch him. What does the angel of death do? In the meantime, a wind blew and howled between the branches. If you are in a swamp, running away from Persian authorities, in complete desolation, and all of a sudden you hear rustling in the bushes, what do you assume? The worst. They're coming for you. Those are the Persian authorities. Rabbi Bar Nachmani thought that the noise was due to an infantry battalion about to capture him. He said, "Let me die and not be given over to the hands of the government." The angel of death was therefore able to take his soul. So here you have the angel of death is escorting Rabbi Bar Nachmani up to heaven, where God is standing on one end of the courtroom, and the Beis Medrash is standing on the other side of the courtroom. God says Tahor, the Beis Medrash says Tameh, and they are eagerly anticipating the arrival of Rabbi Bar Nachmani to decide the case. As he was dying, he said in response to the dispute in heaven, "Tahor, it is pure." A divine voice emerged from heaven and said, "Happy are you, Rabbi Bar Nachmani, as your body is pure and your soul left the world with the word pure." And that is your Gemara. Not a bad way to start the morning. Gemara ate its Wheaties that morning. So what do we see from this Gemara? We see a number of very interesting things. There's heaven. And what you and I had associated with this pristine, utopian version of what heaven looks like is very different than the depiction that the Gemara gives us. The depiction of the Gemara is God and this heavenly Beis Medrash, which we don't know what it looks like or who makes up this heavenly Beis Medrash. It's called Mesifta Derakia, the school in heaven. And what we would think that God and this heavenly Beis Medrash are talking about is not actually what they're talking about. What are they talking about? The obscure laws that you and I are eagerly looking forward to hearing about Shabbos morning for a half hour. That's what they're debating. Now, what makes this all astounding is a number of questions. Number one, out of all the topics for them to be talking about, why are they talking about the laws of leprosy? Are there any Mitzoraim in Shemayim? Are there people plagued with leprosy in heaven? In all likelihood, not. And if that's the case, why, out of all topics in the Torah, for God and his minions to be arguing about, are they arguing about something that is so unbelievably abstract and, quite honestly, inapplicable to the situation that they're facing in heaven? It does not strike us as a conversation that you and I would have anticipated taking place in heaven. In fact, I would argue that if you went to your Shabbos table this week and asked people for a top 20 list of topics that you think God is debating in heaven, the laws of Tzaraat would not make that top 20. And yet, the Gemara chooses this as the topic, as the subject matter for what it is that they're talking about. Number two, I think that's very strange about this Gemara. What does it mean that the Beis Medrash is arguing with God? It's a very hard concept to wrap our head around that they are debating God. When my children debate with me, so we take that debate up until a certain point, and then they get what's called the look. It could be a look or it could be a tone of voice. Either way, it is a very clear indication to my children that the debate has gone on for long enough and it will end right now. You know why? Because I am the boss. And you can argue and debate and kick and scream and cry and want as much candy in the world as you dream of, but the answer is going to be no. And there is a clear understanding in our house. Well, it gets less clear as the kids get older. But my oldest right now is 11, so we're on the brink of it still being pretty clear. But in general, there's a clear indication that when I use that voice or I give the look, my kids know that the debate is over. I would imagine that's similar to what happens in heaven with God. God kind of, he entertains this debate. But at a certain point, you would imagine that God gives the look to his little minions, or he uses the Charlton Heston voice and says, "So it shall," right? No, Tahor, this is the halacha. And yet, somehow, there is this enthusiastic debate that is taking place. How can they argue with God? Question number three, I think, is very strange. You have God on the one hand, and you have an entire Beis Medrash of people on the other hand. In a normal case, let's say that case existed here on this earth, where you and I were debating this halachic topic, is a case of doubt, tahor, tameh. I say tahor, all of you say tameh. In the process of halacha, who would we follow? You or me? You. Majority rules. Achare rabim lahatos. Why don't we apply, or why didn't Rabbah Bar Nachmani apply that same line of reasoning in the debate between God and the Beis Medrash? God is, after all, one person. The Beis Medrash is a group of people. Shouldn't he have applied the same principle of majority rules and therefore said Tamei like the Beis Medrash? Instead, he paskins Tahor like God himself. And I think the third, fourth, strange question, we're not going to answer all these questions, these are just things that popped into my mind, is why does Rabbah Bar Nachmani have to leave the world in order to decide the case? That also is very strange. He has to leave the world, but when does he paskin? Right before he leaves, like as he's leaving the world. The whole sequence of events seems very strange. Let's start offering some suggestions. The first two I'm going to say are a little bit more parenthetical, but very interesting because we're learning the Gemara. And the third one is what's going to catapult us into the discussion that I want to have today. The first is a comment by Professor Chaim Saman, who's a professor of law at Villanova. He just came out with a book called Halacha. And in the introduction to his book on Halacha, he tells, you don't have this, I have this, he tells the story of the Gemara that I just described. And he says exactly what you and I just said, how strange it is that God in heaven is debating this abstract and seemingly inconsequential, unpractical halacha of Saras. And he introduces it with the following. He says, a few years ago, a flyer was posted in the synagogue of an upper middle class Orthodox community outside New York City, whose congregants tend to be doctors, lawyers, real estate developers, business people, and white collar professionals. The flyer publicized a lecture to be delivered on Shabbat afternoon by a guest rabbi visiting from another community. Most of the information provided was routine. The rabbi's name, the time, place of lecture, names of sponsors who made it possible. On any given weekend, similar announcements can be found in thousands of churches and community centers around the country. But two things set this announcement apart. One was the topic of the lecture. Quote, bidding competitively on goods or properties when others are previously involved. That was the title of the lecture. By a show of hands, who's coming to that lecture? Not many people. An issue vaguely related to what lawyers call tortious interference with contract. The other was the rabbi's title, Dean of an Advanced Institute of Talmudic Study specializing in business and commercial law, what we would call Choshen Mishpat. For a professor who teaches the subject of contract law, talking about himself at that point, the details to be discussed by the afternoon lecture might be fascinating. Indeed, in any other setting in contemporary America, a lecture under this title would be delivered by a law professor, speaking to students or academic colleagues, or by an attorney addressing clients. The subject is hardly a matter of general interest, and certainly of dubious appeal to a lay audience, much less to anyone in search of spiritual fulfillment. If I come to shul to find spiritual fulfillment, why do I want to hear a lecture about contracts and law? And yet, on that Shabbat afternoon, nearly 150 lay individuals came out to hear the rabbi guide them through the bylaws of a Talmudic discussion. Why? For those involved, the answer is clear. They did not see the event as a lecture either on law or on anything related to the concerns of business or commercial life. They didn't see it as detailed, minute, trivial halacha or law. Rather, as an opportunity to participate in a quintessentially spiritual experience. The study of law, the study of Torah, an activity that competes not only with such other spiritual enterprises as prayer and good works, and not only with other intellectual interests like studying philosophy, art, or science, but with virtually every other human pursuit, up to and including the basic need of earning a living. Instead, following the guide of God and the angels in the heavenly academy, the congregation was engaged in a devotional act. In other words, the pursuit of halacha, this complicated, seemingly unapplicable, abstract area of law is, in and of itself, he argues, a spiritual pursuit. What we would call Torah Lishma. We learn Torah. We involve ourselves in the world of Talmud, not necessarily only because it's going to be practical at the end of our conversation, but because we believe studying halacha in and of itself is a divine act and brings us closer to God. The Talmud, and for so many other Jews today, is heaven. How does the Gemara describe heaven? As debating these abstract laws, not necessarily because it's going to have any practical underpinnings, but because the search for truth in that body of law is in and of itself an avenue to bring us close to God. That's an astounding, unique approach of Judaism that differs it from perhaps other avenues of study. And here comes back to what someone else said at the beginning. That study is for Grant Gilmore, one of the 20th century's best known professors of law, what he calls hell, Gehenna. He says the better the society, the less law there will be. In heaven, there will be no law. The worse the society, the more law there will be. In hell, there will be nothing but law, and due process will be meticulously observed. So how does Gilmore describe heaven? Having no laws whatsoever. Hell is full of laws. That might resonate with some people in this room. Judaism obviously views it the exact opposite. What is taking place in heaven? Specifically the study of abstract and unapplicable laws. That, says Professor Saiman, is the greatness of our Gemara. The greatness of our Gemara is the awareness that what are they studying in heaven? They're not just studying practical things, but they are specifically studying things which are abstract and unapplicable, because that body of study is in and of itself what brings us closer to Hashem. That is what I'll call just a parenthetical idea, which I think is very pretty. I think it's very, it gives us a lot of room for thought. Everyone's encouraged to read his book. I've not read it in its entirety. I read the introduction in the first chapter, but it's pretty amazing, certainly for people who study halacha, people who live lives of halacha, a word and a concept we don't oftentimes take a step back and think about. So it's a book that is certainly worthwhile studying. What's interesting, though, is the Rambam. The Rambam, when he paskins this halacha, again, you have God says, we have a doubt. Whether the hair comes first or the spot comes first, whether the spot comes first or the hair comes first, God says tahor. The Heavenly Academy says tameh. Rabbi Bar Nachmani says tahor. He sides with God. By the way, in general, that's a good thing to do. Siding with God. The Rambam, when he paskins this halacha, though, in his Hilchos Negaim, paskins like the Heavenly Academy. He paskins tame, against Hashem and against Rabbi Bar Nachmani. How could that be that the Rambam paskins against God? The answer is, in halachic terms, that the Rambam was following a principle that you and I just spoke about. That when you have many and few, who do you paskin like? You paskin like the many. Achrei Rabbam Lahatos. And therefore the Rambam comes along and paskins like the Heavenly Academy. He says tummy. But perhaps we can share a little bit more of a beautiful insight into why it is that you have God and you have the Heavenly Academy, and we, the Rambam, paskin like the majority tummy. So if we turn your page over, I want to share with you a beautiful insight from the Yalkut Yehuda, Rav Yehuda Leib Ginsburg, who was a rabbi in Denver in the earlier part of the 20th century. He writes the following. On the bottom, you see a bunch of underlines. First, he introduces us to this Gemara. He introduces us to the Rambam who paskins against God. So God says Tahor, and the Rambam says Tameh. Why is that? And he says the following. Uvederech HaDrush, he says homiletically, Efshar lomar bezekein, dihine hanegayim bayim machmas chet. Why does this affliction occur because of a sin. V'hine b'shashi yesh safek b'nega, imu tahor o tame. When you have a debate whether you are tame or tahor, afflicted with sin or not afflicted with sin, yesh lecha safek ima ish hazeh bal averahu olo. What you're really arguing about is, did this person sin or not? When you come to the Kohen and there is a doubt whether you are Tame or Tahor, what you're really asking the Kohen is, did I sin or did I not sin? Imagine having that conversation with the Kohen. Imagine having to come to Rabbi Goldberg or myself and say, I did the following. Did I speak Lashon Hara or not? Am I a bad person or not? I mean, that's essentially the conversation that took place between a person in the Kohen. Says Rabbi Ginsburg, V'nei ha'adam tzarech litlos es atzmo shebevadai chet v'lakach ba'alav ha'baharis. When you view yourself, what do we have to view ourselves as? Tame. Says the Yalkut Yehuda, you don't give ourselves, we shouldn't give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. We have to view ourselves as guilty. We have to introspect, recognize that in all likelihood we did something wrong, and fix it. Ubazeh ba be'ofen sheyudi tamei. We have to look at ourselves, going over to the left-hand column, we have to look at ourselves as if we are tamei. Hainu shekadmas ha-beheres l'seyar lavan. We have to view it that the sore came before the white skin. Uveshasha adam machzik etz atzmo lechote, kvar hu omed b'madrega gavoa. If we introspect and see faults in ourselves, recognize that we're not perfect, see the need for improvement, that already puts us up on a very high level, because what does the average person do? The average person rationalizes it to himself. Or he very quickly forgives himself. He says, you know what? I'm not so bad. It was just one little action. What's the big deal? So I spoke Lashon Hara about the rabbi. Who cares? No one, he's never going to fight. By the way, we find out about everything. You know how we find out about everything? Because there are people in the shul. This is classic. They come up to us. They say, Rabbi, I didn't participate in the conversation. But let me tell you what I heard at the Shabbos table. Thanks, but no thanks, right? What exactly do you answer to that? Rabbi, we love that. Rabbi Goldberg and I always get a, it wasn't me, but let me tell you what they were talking about with friends like these, okay? So we oftentimes rationalize things. It wasn't so bad. Maybe I didn't do it. Says the Yalkut Yehuda, when viewing ourselves, we have to view ourselves as if we're tummy. It's not so bad every now and then to introspect, to realize that we're not perfect, and that we need room for improvement. And so the second we do that, that automatically puts us up on a pedestal, because the average person doesn't do that. In V'HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer Alav Shu Beli Chet V'Hu Tahor. Whereas we're supposed to see faults in ourselves, what does Hashem see? Hashem, who looks at our broader selves, He gives us the benefit of the doubt. And He views us as we are Tahor. He says, you know what? You may have sinned this time, but there were mitigating circumstances. It's because I know that you can't overcome the temptation, or because of the circumstances. And so Hashem is able to forgive us. That, says the Yalkut Yehuda, is the dispute that happened in the Gemara. God says Tahor, because He looks at us, and because He's so benevolent and generous, He says, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, you're Tahor. The Masifta Derakia, those representing mankind, look at our faults, and what do they say? Tameh. That is exactly how the dynamic that's supposed to take place between us and God. He says, Aval Kadosh Baruch Hu Machriya Tameh Es Adam L'Kaf Zchus. God always gives us the benefit of the doubt, and therefore He says, Tahor. Aval Anachnu La'atzmeinu. But when we view ourselves, Eifshar Lanu La'achriya Es Atzmeinu L'Kaf Zchus. We shouldn't always be so quick to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. We're very good at that. We have to be more machmir on ourselves. And therefore, when talking to us, how does the Rambam paskin? The Rambam says, tame. That when we view ourselves, we have to view ourselves with self-criticism. Not in a mental health way, right? Not in a way that causes us unnecessary pain and distress. But we need a certain healthy sense of self-introspection, of self-criticism. And so what you have here, I think, is a magnificent interpretation of our Gemara. When mankind looks at themselves, we are supposed to say we're tameh. We're supposed to recognize that we're not perfect, that we have faults, and that we have the room for improvement. When God looks at us, God gives us the benefit of the doubt. Hashem loves us. Same way you love a child. And even though they might not be perfect, right? My mother, when she sees my children, all she sees is perfection. Drives me crazy. I tell her not to get involved. She's listening to this. I love you, Mom. But sometimes, right? Grandparents only see their perfection in their grandchildren. The parent, on the other hand, who has to sit with them every day, trust me, kids aren't perfect. Okay, that's exactly the dynamic here. Hashem is the grandparent. He sees our perfection. He gives us the benefit of the doubt. He sees tahor. But when we view ourselves, says the Yalkut Yehuda, we need a little bit more sense of self-criticism. We need to be more critical of ourselves.
Hashem follows the Maamar Chazal.
Correct. Hashem views us with kol adam. So good, we're going to get to that. Now I'm going to suggest this morning that what's true of ourselves, how we're supposed to maintain that critical, again, in a healthy way, awareness of our faults, is not true of each other. I'm supposed to recognize what's wrong with me, but it's not my business to recognize what's wrong with you. And for that, I direct you to a different pasuk in our parsha this morning. The pasuk says, "Vira hakohen es hanega," that you're going to bring the fault to the kohen. You don't have this. "Beora basar v'sear benega hafach lavan." It's going to have turned white. "Umare hanega amok meor basar nega tzarat." Again, you're bringing it to the kohen. The kohen's taking a look at this, and then the end of the pasuk is, "Viraahu hakohen." The kohen will see it. Vitime oso, and the kohen will make him tame. Now you'll notice that in that pasuk there is a redundancy. The pasuk starts off and says, "Vira hakohen es hanega," the kohen is going to see the nega. And the pasuk ends, "Viraahu hakohen," the kohen will see it again. It could have left the second "Viraahu hakohen" out. It already told me at the beginning of the pasuk that the Kohen saw it. This is repetitive. It uses the exact same verbiage, and the question is why. So let me share with you a beautiful insight that I came across a number of years ago. The Kohen has to look at this nega twice. The first time is the Kohen looks at the affliction. Vira hakohen es hanega. The Kohen, with that same critical eye that you and I are supposed to use for ourselves, the Kohen looks at this nega. And he sees the blemish. He knows that the person sinned. And he has to adjudicate the case based on seeing the blemish of another person, whether or not it technically meets the criteria of tzaras. But then the pasuk comes along again at the end. Vira'ahu hakohen. The kohen then has to come back and look once again, only this time the kohen is not focused on the person's shortcomings. What does he have to do? Doesn't say "Virahu HaKohen Asanega" the second time. "Virahu HaKohen." The Kohen has to once again look at the person, and he has to look past the bumps, the bruises, the warts, the blemishes, the tzaras, and he also has to notice the rest of the person. He has to pay attention to all of the person's good qualities. And so the pasuk tells us that the Kohen has to look at this person twice. The first time he comes and he's looking at the person's blemishes. What's wrong with the person? That's very easy. The pasuk therefore comes along and tells us that, Mr. Kohen, you also have to come back before telling the person what's wrong with him. You have to see the rest of the person. You have to see the entire person. You see, it's very easy for us to come to one another, for a Kohen to come to us and see what's wrong with us. That's easy for us to do. It's a lot harder for us to come back and to look at what is good about the person, their positive qualities, what they are doing right. And so therefore, the pasuk tells us that the kohen has to look twice. Once to see the nega, once to see the blemish of another person, but the second time to see past the nega, to see beyond the blemishes of the other person, to see beyond their faults, their failures, and their shortcomings. So what is true of ourselves is not true of other people. That when we come to another person, it's very easy. We are all very quick to notice each other's faults and failures and shortcomings. And therefore, the Torah warns us that when looking at another person, you have to look a second time. You have to also recognize what's good about them, the positive qualities, the positive attributes that they bring to the table. Nowhere is this clearer, in my mind, than the Haftorah that we're going to read, not for this week's Parsha, but for next week's Parsha. The Parsha, the Haftorah from Mitzora, again, many years, Tazri and Mitzora come together, but it's the same kind of topic. The Haftorah for Parshas Mitzora, to me, is one of the most astounding stories in all of Tanakh. And it's astounding because it's so relevant to our conversation right now. The story takes place in the time of Elisha. The nation of Aram is besieging the Shomron in the northern kingdom of Israel. There is a famine as a result of the siege. There is a severe drought that is overtaking the nation. In the previous perek of the Navi, not in the Haftorah from Mitzora, but right before that, it describes a scenario that is nothing short of a Holocaust. Scenes of women in the streets eating their children. Literally, this is what the Navi describes, cooking their children to ward off the effects of starvation. That's what the Navi is describing. That's the horrific scenario that we're talking about right now. In the context of that starvation, in the context of that plague, the Haftorah for Parshas Mitzora opens up, very famously, with four Mitzorayim. The Arba Nashim Hayu Mitzorayim Pesach Hashar. Again, it's on page 1172. It's not our Haftorah for this week, but it fits the theme that we're talking about. And it's Navi, you can learn that anytime. Four Mitzoraim, lepers, people who, because of sin, are ostracized from the community. And it's not just any sin, it's a sin that they spoke negatively about other people in the community. So they've been isolated, they've been kicked out, they've been ostracized from the community, and they're sitting outside. And what happens? They recognize that one of two things is going to happen to them. Either they are going to starve to death and die, or they can defect to the Aramean camp, not Armenian, Aramean camp, and hopefully they'll at least get a little food there. That's how desperate the situation is. It's either death or giving yourselves over to the hands of the enemy. So what do they decide? They say, L'chu v'nipla el machane Aram, let's go to the camp of Aram, im yichayunu nichyeh. If they let us live, we'll live. V'im yimusinu, and if they kill us, v'masnu, we're going to die anyways. That's what's called between a rock and a hard place. There's no good answer to that. So what happens? At twilight, the lepers come to the camp of Aram, expecting to give themselves over, and they are shocked to find that the camp is completely empty. Nothing is there. Unbeknownst to them, Hashem had caused a miracle to take place where the people of Aram had heard chariots and horses. They feared an attack was pending, and so they ran away. And so when these four lepers come to the camp, what do they find? Food, drink, gold, silver. They hit the jackpot, literally. And so they start eating and drinking and taking all the gold and the silver, and they say to themselves, we don't need all of this. We can't possibly use all of this for ourselves. Let's share it with the rest of the Jewish people. Astounding in and of itself. This is a Jewish camp that had just thrown these four people out, literally left them to die on the outskirts of the camp, and they're choosing not to be selfish, but to be selfless. So they come back to the Jewish camp and they say, the people of Aram left. Their camp is empty. There's a treasure trove of gold and silver and food and drink. Let's all go. And what do the Jewish people think? They think it's a trap. They don't believe them. They don't think it's the case. We spoke about on Shabbos, the Eichmann trial, that when they first approached the Mossad, that they thought Eichmann was hiding out in Argentina, the Mossad didn't believe them. They thought it was also a ruse So that's exactly what's happening here. Eventually they send out some spies, they realize it's true, the camp is empty, and the people of Israel come, they take the food, the gold, the silver from the camp of Aram, and they are saved. It's an amazing turn of events. Literally going from zero to hero in the matter of a few psukim. But what's astounding about the whole story is who are the heroes of the Haftorah? Who are the heroes of this story of Tanakh? This astounding, shocking story of Tanakh? None other than four lepers. If you and I were writing the story, who would be the heroes? We would envision some pious rabbi with a long beard, steeped over and studying Talmud day and night. That's not who the heroes of the story are. Remarkably, the heroes of the story are four lepers. Four individuals that were so imperfect, so ridden with sin, that the Jewish people had to kick them out of camp. Four people that were overlooked, snubbed, disregarded because of their nega, because of their faults, and so they were ostracized from the camp. And yet, what is the Haftorah, what is this story in Sefer Malachim Bet encourage us to do? It encourages us to look at these four Mitzorayim and say, before you kick them out, before you only look at their fault, maybe take a second look and realize that despite their shortcomings, maybe there is an element of goodness in them as well. That's the message of that Haftorah. The Haftorah, the part of Malachim Bet, encourages us not just to look at one part of the person, but to look at the person as a whole. And the message is exactly the message of the two vera'as that we find in our pasuk. Vera'ah ha-kohen et hanega. Yes, it's important as a kohen to notice and recognize the flaw in another person. But you then have to come back a second time. Vera'ahu ha-kohen. You have to come back and you have to look at the rest of the person. You see, this might come as a shock to many of us. But none of us are perfect. None of us are perfect. I know it's hard to believe. But none of us are perfect. We each have our own faults, our own shortcomings. We each have our own nega. But here's what happens. We wake up in the morning, we look at ourselves in the mirror, and we say, you know what? I might not be perfect, but overall I'm a good person. So I'm going to give myself the benefit of the doubt. That same approach is simply what the Torah expects us to have of each other. Because we do the opposite with each other. We notice one fall in another person. Might be their ego, it might be the fact that they talk a little bit too loud, it might be that they dress we notice things about other people, and we judge them very quickly, and we ignore the rest of the person. Comes along our parsha, Vira'ahu ha-kohen, the kohen has to come back, and he has to look a second time at the person, because he has to see the rest of the person, to take a second look. I believe there's such an important concept that whereas for ourselves it's important to be critical, it's important to recognize our nega, that's the only way we're going to improve. But when it comes to other people, it's not just enough to focus on that small element. You have to take a second look. Vera'ah kohen es hanega. All of us are very good at that part of it. We're very good at recognizing the faults of each other, and therefore the Torah comes back and says Vera'ahu ha-kohen. You have to come back and look at the person a second time. And so I encourage you, how different our world would be if we actually lived this way. How different would the world be if when we looked at our friends or our colleagues or our family or our neighbors, Pesach is coming out. So God willing, you're going to be surrounded by family in likely small quarters, which if you're like my family, means that everyone's just going to sing Kumbaya and hug and, you know, kiss all day. But I heard there might be some families were in small quarters. So, you know, sometimes the best of a family will come out. I always think when I grew up, so we used to go to my bubby's house for Pesach. And when I was a child, the house seemed a lot bigger than it actually is. We drove by it two summers ago. It was very small. And the most remarkable part about it was that there were over 20 people in the house. And there was 1.5 bathrooms. So just picture the scenario. Lots of matzah. 20 people. 1.5 bathrooms. And a relative who insisted on taking a shower every morning from 8 to 9. So you can imagine that we all sat around and sang Kumbaya together over a 3-day yantif. But that's what happens. So can you imagine how different it would be if instead of judging people just based on one nega, just based on one blemish that we're all very quick to notice, you took a step back, vera'u ha-kohen, and you allowed yourself to take a second look at the rest of the person. Imagine how different our community would be if instead of seeing one part of a person, the clothes they wear, the hat that's on their head or not on their head, the kippah that they're wearing, the type of dress, where they send their children to school, what community, what development, what car. If instead of just noticing one part of a person, you then allowed yourself to step back and to see the rest of the person, how different our world would be if we employed the laws of tzarat. Not just vera'a koina sanega, not just to see each other's blemishes, something that you and I are all very good at, but also vera'u ha-kohen, to come back a second time and to look beyond a blemish, to look beyond one part of a spirit of a superficiality of another person, and to instead allow ourselves to see the rest of the person. This is not just a pasuk, it's not just a haftorah for next week's parsha, but it's an explicit halacha, I believe, in the laws of tzarat. The Rambam is explicit when he says the following. I'm sorry, the Mishnah is explicit when it says the following. This is the Mishnah in Nagayim, chapter 2, Mishnah 3. Suma be'echad me'inav, lo yira es ha-Nagayim. The Mishnah tells us that if a Kohen is blind in one eye, he's not able to look at the blemish of someone with tzarat. Why not? What's wrong with a Kohen with one eye? He still has one functional eye. He can see. What's the message of the Mishnah? The message of the Mishnah is exactly our point. That a Kohen needs to have two eyes in order to look at the Nega. One eye is to look at the Nega, to look at the blemish. But you need a second eye. You need to have that broader perspective. I am not an optometrist, but I saw this play out on Sunday morning. There was a teen in our community, something happened on Shabbos with a basketball, but he had stitches over one of his eyes, and it was very swollen. And so during davening, it was, you know, when you go to the fair, there's the weird person who everyone pays to see. That's what it was like for the teenagers on Sunday morning in shul. Everyone wanted to come over, and they were having fun with this kid who was a little bit, his eye was a little bit off. But one of the things that I noticed was that when he didn't have the eye, so your vision, you can see, but what do you lack? Peripheral vision. Perspective. You can see in a very narrow perspective, but you miss the broader picture. That, I believe, is what the Mishnah is telling us. That a one-eyed Kohen, yes, he could see directly what's in front of him. You show him a blemish, he'll be able to see the blemish. But you know what he'll lack? He'll lack the peripheral vision. He'll lack the rest of the person. And that's why it's so important for a Kohen not just to have one eye, but a Kohen to have two eyes. It's not just enough to see the nega. You have to see the rest of the person as well. Exactly what we're talking about. Think about how Bilam is described. What characteristic does the Talmud tell us Bilam had? Bilam was blind in one eye. Now, whether or not Bilam actually had one eye or not, or whether the Talmud is teaching us a lesson, it's clear what the lesson is. Bilam only had one of those eyes. Which eye was it? The critical eye. And so Bilam comes to the Jewish people, and what does he immediately see? What's wrong with us? You can look at the Jewish community, and you can say, ah, this guy cheated on his taxes, all Jews are bad. You can look at the Jewish people, find fault, find a nega, and stop right there. Bilam was blind in one eye. He only saw the nega of the Jewish people. What did he lack? He lacked that perspective. He lacked that peripheral vision. He lacked the ability to come back like the Kohen is responsible to do, Vira'u HaKohen, to come back a second time and to see the rest of the Jewish people. He only saw the negative, and he never allowed himself to see the positive. And so what I believe you have here is a message that the Torah is very clearly communicating to us. which is that when it comes to view blemishes of ourselves, we need an element of criticism. It's important to not think you're perfect. Because if you think you're perfect, if you think you've arrived, you're never going to improve. So in a healthy sense, as the Rambam paskind, we have to view ourselves as tameh. We have to view ourselves as impure. We have to always be looking for ways to improve ourselves and to make ourselves just a little bit better. But when it comes to seeing other people, so then, vera kohen asanega. Yes, we're all very good at seeing the blemishes of each other. But you know what else we need? We need a second perspective. We need vera'u akohen. We need to come back and see the rest of the person. We can't just view each other with one eye, with an eye of negativity, with an eye of criticism, with an eye of cynicism. But we need that second eye. We need that peripheral vision where we allow ourselves to see the rest of the person. That's what Bilam lacked. Bilam was blind. Think about the contrast in Tanakh between Bilam and Avram. Avram Avinu, everything is about seeing. Verasa makom merachok. Avram is able to see. Who's he walking with? He's walking with Yitzchak. He's walking with Eliezer. And he's walking with Yishmael. They come to the same place. Two of them are able to see, two of them are not able to see. Avram is defined by that vision. He's able to see that broader perspective. Bilam has only one eye. Bilam is narrowly focused on what's in front of him. He only sees the criticism in another person. He only sees the negativity in another person. He doesn't allow himself to see the broad person as a whole. This, I believe, which applies to each other, applies to society as a whole. The Medrash tells us the following. I'll read to you in English. Why does Hashem command not that infections should be shown to a person from Israel, but rather only to a Kohen? Think about how strange that is. The Kohanim are the top of the totem pole. And yet, what are we showing them? These disgusting blemishes, these disgusting wounds on a person. Isn't that pasnish for a Kohen? Shouldn't you choose the lowly Yisraelim like me to look at blemishes? Why waste the Kohen's time? Says the Medrash, for just as they, namely the Kohanim, receive the gifts, Kohanim get the benefits of a Kohen, similarly, they must receive the troubles. What does that mean? That the Medrash links the fact that the Kohen receives the gift with the fact that the Kohen also has to know about the troubles of the Jewish people. I think this is a beautiful idea. What the Medrash, I believe, is telling us is that it's not enough for a Kohen, to sit in his ivory tower and to enjoy the benefits of being a Kohen. You know what the Kohen needs? He needs to go out of the Mikdash. He can't be confined, but he needs to see the people as a whole. If the Kohen just stood in the ivory tower, there's a reason we call it an ivory tower. It's a pejorative term. What does it mean? It means that you have your very narrowly focused approach to society. The fact that the Kohanim also had to go out and to interact with people, even the worst and the best of people, meant that the Torah required the Kohen, who are the leaders of the people, to have that broad perspective of society. They needed to see the people as a whole, not just one narrow aspect of society. We do this in our day and age. I remember right after the election, last year. Was it last year, 2 years ago? Couple months ago, I don't remember, whenever it was. So as you remember, all of the pundits were predicting that Clinton would win and Trump would lose. And all of the polls were wrong. Again, this is not a political statement, it's a statement about how we approach each other. I remember David Brooks, columnist for the New York Times, wrote an article right after the election. And he said, it just shows us how narrow we have become and our awareness of American society. We live in bubbles. We live in narrow communities where we view the world through our narrow community. So if I live in a liberal community, I think the whole world is liberal. If I live in a conservative community, I think the whole world is liberal, a conservative. And I only experience the world through Fox News and Wall Street Journal, or I only experience the world through CNN and the New York Times. And that's the totality of my perspective. And his advice to American society and to pundits was, if you want to get to know America, You have to burst out of your bubble and experience communities that are different than yours. And so he said, if you live in the Northeast, it's time to go to Middle America. And if you live in Middle America, it's time to go to the coasts a little bit more. That's the only way you're not just going to get to know one narrow part of our community, but to get to know America as a whole. That is what the Medrash is telling us. It's not just enough for the Kohen to sit in his Dalet Amos of the Beis HaMikdash. But the Kohen had to go out. The Kohen had to see people. The warts, the bumps, the bruises, the good, the bad, and the ugly, because that's how you get to know not just one element, but that's how you get to know the rest of society. And so that's what the Torah is encouraging us through the laws of Tzaras, through the laws of Tazria and Mitzora, is that narrowness is not a good thing. It's not a good thing when we approach each other. I shouldn't just look at one part of you, but I have to look at the rest of you. I shouldn't just notice what's wrong with you, what your nega is, what your blemish is, and stop there and allow that to define who you are. But I have to vera'u ha-kohen, I have to take a step back and to look at the rest of you and to say that none of us are perfect. In the same way I have my warts and bumps and bruises and blemishes, but I would hope that people would give me the benefit of the doubt, I have to share that same benefit of the doubt with you. And it applies to society as a whole. We should never allow ourselves to become so narrow focused on the way we view the Jewish community, American community, the world, but we should allow ourselves to get to know society as a whole. That is how we don't live Jews as one-eyed, but we live our Judaism with two eyes, with the broader perspective of each other, with the broader perspective of the world. And that, I believe, is what Hashem wants us to appreciate through these sometimes obscure and abstract laws of Tzaras. Everyone have a wonderful week.